Okay, so before we get into today's deep dive, a really quick shout out. This deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel.
Oh, yeah, they're great. Yeah.
If you're tackling the Series 24, they have a full course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams that are weighted just like the real thing. Check it out at certfuel.com. Trust me, it is genuinely a lifesaver for this exam.
Oh,
Okay,
totally.
so back to the content. Imagine stepping up to the velvet rope of the most exclusive, high-stakes nightclub in the world.
Okay.
But, this isn't a normal club. The bouncer at the front door isn't just checking if you're 21. He's running a background check against international terrorism databases.
Right.
And the security cameras on the ceiling aren't just like watching for fights. They are algorithmically tracking exactly how much cash you hand to the bartender to see if you're running a cartel operation.
That is an incredibly stressful nightclub.
Right. I mean, who wants to go there? But that is exactly what a broker-dealer is.
Yeah.
It's a financial fortress. And today we are learning the rules for the bouncer, the cameras, and the exit doors. Our mission today is conquering function three of the Series 24 exam: account opening and anti-money laundering.
And, regulators pair these topics together for a very specific reason. Intake, monitoring, and exit they're a single continuous chain.
Right.
A failure at the front door almost inevitably leads to failures on the trading floor. Like, if you let a ghost or some synthetic identity into your firm on day one, you're going to have rampant money laundering on day 30, and you're going to have massive data leaks by day 90. The rules are deeply interconnected.
And because this material can get, incredibly dense, we need a way to make it stick. We need a cinematic universe.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah. So, listener, as you are walking the dog or driving to work right now, I want you to vividly visualize three recurring characters we're going to follow today. First, meet Cautious Carl. He is the nervous, constantly sweating compliance principal at our fictional broker-dealer. He just clutches a stress ball and lives in perpetual fear of a surprise audit.
I feel bad for Carl already.
Right. Next, we have Shady Sally. She is the customer who is always doing slightly suspicious things.
Right.
She never quite crosses the line into blatant illegality on day one, but everything she does is just weird.
Just pushing the envelope.
Exactly. And finally, Departing Dave. He is the registered rep who is always trying to jump ship to a rival firm and take his clients with him.
I have absolutely worked with all three of those people. In fact, Cautious Carl is basically the patron saint of compliance officers.
So true. So let's set the scene. Cautious Carl is sitting at his very organized desk, squeezing his stress ball. Door opens, and Shady Sally walks in to open a new brokerage account.
Nope.
Now, Cautious Carl immediately has to satisfy two distinct sets of rules just to get her through the front door. He's got the FINRA customer account information rules, and he's got the Patriot Act's customer identification program, which we call the CIP.
Right, the CIP.
Now, at a glance, these sound like the exact same thing. Carl's just collecting her ID, right? What is the actual fundamental difference here?
Well, the difference is entirely about the underlying purpose, the why behind the regulation. The FINRA customer account information rule is administrative.
Okay.
It's about building a customer profile.
Okay.
FINRA wants the firm to know who to contact, what her tax status is, who the assigned rep is, and making sure a principal approves the relationship.
Right.
It's the administrative spine of the account.
Sure.
But the CIP, the customer identification program, that is a federal anti-terrorism mandate born out of the ashes of 9/11.
So it's not just paperwork, it's national security.
Exactly that.
Yeah.
Its entire purpose is verification. It is about proving that Shady Sally is a living, breathing human being
Yeah.
and not a synthetic identity created by, a state-sponsored hacking group or a drug cartel. Think of it this way. FINRA is saying, tell me about yourself. The CIP is saying, prove you exist.
Prove you exist.
Yeah.
I love that distinction. Let's dig into the CIP first, because national security obviously takes precedence.
Sure.
Cautious Carl needs to verify Sally. What are the absolute non-negotiable elements he has to extract from her before she gets past the velvet rope?
So there are four mandatory elements under the CIP. It is a
Yeah.
rigid list: name,
Okay.
date of birth,
Right.
a physical address,
Right.
and an identification number.
Hold on, let me pause you at physical address. Shady Sally doesn't want Carl knowing where she sleeps. Can she just hand him a P.O. box address?
Absolutely not.
Really?
Yeah, and that is a very common exam scenario.
Yeah.
For a U.S. citizen, a standard P.O. box alone is never sufficient for the CIP.
Oh, wow.
It must be a physical residential or business street address. Now, the regulators allow military APOs or rural route numbers if you live out in the middle of nowhere, but a standard post office box gets flatly rejected by cautious Carl. The government needs to know what door to knock on if things go south.
That makes total sense. Now let's talk about that fourth element, the identification number. For almost everyone born in the U.S., that's a social security number. But let me throw a wrench in the gears.
Let's do it.
What if Shady Sally just moved to the United States from overseas?
Mm-hmm.
She legally applied for a social security number, but, you know, the federal government is notoriously slow. She doesn't have the card yet.
Right.
She just has an application receipt. Can cautious Carl open her account today?
This is a fantastic question, and it is a massive exam trap. The short answer is yes. Carl can open the account under what's called the TIN application exception.
TIN.
Yeah, TIN stands for Taxpayer Identification Number. If she has applied for it and the firm has a reasonable belief they'll get it within a reasonable period, the account can open.
Okay.
But here is the trap, and I want the listener to lean in for this.
Mm-hmm.
The TIN application exception only applies to U.S. persons.
Wait, really? Right. The exception discriminates based on citizenship.
It does. If Sally is a non-U.S. person, a foreign citizen, she cannot use the TIN application exception.
Oh.
She can't just say, oh, I'm waiting on my paperwork. Instead, she must provide an alternative, heavily vetted government ID.
Like what?
Specifically, she needs to provide a passport number plus the country of issuance or an alien identification card. The exam writers will absolutely try to trick you by offering the TIN exception to a foreign national in a multiple choice question.
That is devious. So let me synthesize that to make sure it sticks. If you have a U.S. person waiting on their social security card, the exception applies. Let them in. But if you have a foreign person waiting on paperwork, hard stop. Show me the passport and the specific country that issued it.
You've got it. And we have to remember, cautious Carl doesn't just write this CIP data down on a notepad and call it a day. He has to verify it.
Right.
He has to actually form a reasonable belief that he knows her true identity. He can do this through documentary methods like physically inspecting her unexpired driver's license,
yeah,
or non-documentary methods like running a credit bureau check or checking mm-hmm. public databases.
Okay, so the CIP is satisfied. Sally has successfully proven she isn't a ghost.
Right.
Now, cautious Carl exhales, puts down his stress ball, and switches hats to the fine RA customer account info rule. He is now building her profile. He gets her name, confirms her residence, verifies she's of legal age in her specific state, and documents her employment status.
Yeah.
And then he brings up the trusted contact person, the TCP.
Right. For any non-institutional account, meaning regular retail investors, Fine RA requires the broker-dealer to make a reasonable effort to obtain the name and information of a trusted contact person.
Okay.
The industry introduced this a few years ago, primarily to combat the massive surge in the financial exploitation of seniors. It's someone the firm can call if they suspect Sally is being scammed, or if her mental faculties start declining, or frankly, if she just drops off the grid and they can't reach her for months.
Okay, listener, this is for you. Direct question time. Pause whatever you are doing and think about this. Cautious Carl slides the form across the desk and asks Shady Sally to list a trusted contact person. Sally, being highly secretive, flat out refuses. She crosses her arms and says, absolutely not. Nobody gets my contact info. Did cautious Carl just violate the Fine RA rule by opening her account anyway? I'll give you a second. Okay, the answer is no. The rule requires the firm to ask. It requires a reasonable effort to obtain the info. The customee is not required to actually provide it.
Right.
As long as Carl meticulously documents that he requested the TCP and Sally formally refused, he is 100% compliant.
That is a critical distinction. The regulators can't force customers to have friends or family they trust.
Yeah.
And there are a couple of other TCP exam traps to watch out for. First, the TCP must be at least 18 years old.
Okay.
Sally cannot name her incredibly mature 16-year-old nephew. Second, and this is vital, the TCP is for contact and communication only.
Oh, really?
They have absolutely zero trading authority. They cannot execute stock trades. They cannot liquidate positions. And they certainly cannot wire money out of the account. It is strictly an emergency contact, nothing more.
The TCP cannot touch the money. Got it. Okay, so Carl has gathered every conceivable piece of information. The paperwork is completely filled out. Now, the account needs to be signed to become official. Who signs the new account form? Obviously, Shady Sally signs it, but what about the firm side? Departing Dave is the registered rep on the account. He's the one who is going to be earning commissions off Sally's trades. Does Dave sign the form?
He does not.
Wait, what?
And this surprises a lot of candidates. Under the Fine RA rule, the principal, our guy Cautious Carl, must sign to accept the account on behalf of the firm.
Okay.
The registered representative signature is not required by the rule, though the rep's name and ID number must certainly be recorded on the file.
Why is that? Why doesn't Dave have to sign?
Because Dave has a conflict of interest. Dave wants the commission. Dave will open an account for a golden retriever if it means he gets a payout.
That's hilarious and true.
The principal is the gatekeeper. Cautious Carl's signature is the ultimate sign-off that says, I have reviewed this, it complies with all federal and self-regulatory rules, and the firm assumes the risk of taking on this client.
Carl's signature is the final deadbolt on the door. I love that. Okay, the account is officially open, the ink is dry, but now, warning, time for a timeline battle.
Oh boy. The timeline battles are where candidates drop the most points.
Exactly. We have two massive competing record-keeping rules clashing right here at the front door. We have the FINRA customer account info versus the federal CIP. Listener, I want you to visualize two giant heavy steel filing cabinets sitting in Cautious Carl's office. One is painted blue for FINRA, one is painted red for the Patriot Act. Let's compare their expiration dates side by side.
Okay, let's open the blue FINRA cabinet first. For the FINRA customer account information, Carl has an ongoing duty. He has to verify and update that profile data at least every 36 months. He has to send it to Sally and say, is this still accurate?
Nah.
But more importantly, when Sally eventually gets mad and closes her account, Carl must keep that FINRA file locked in the blue cabinet for exactly 6 years after the account is closed.
6 years post-closure for FINRA. Okay. Mm-hmm. But what about the red cabinet, the federal CIP cabinet?
So the CIP cabinet holds the raw identity verification data, the copies of the driver's licenses, the credit checks. And under the Patriot Act, Carl must keep that identifying information for 5 years after the account is closed.
Okay, let me repeat that because this is where the exam writers make their money. FINRA information, keep for 6 years after the account closes. CIP information. Keep for 5 years after the account closes. Six for FINRA, five for CIP.
Yeah.
So the exam will give you a scenario where an auditor walks into Carl's office 5.5 years after Sally leaves and asks to see her files.
And if that happens, Carl better hand over the FINRA profile data, but he can honestly say, I shredded the CIP identity verification data 6 months ago, and he would be perfectly compliant.
Mm.
It is an incredibly easy way for the exam to test if you truly understand the mechanical differences between the two rules.
Incredible. Okay, Shady Sally is officially a member of the club. The velvet rope is closed behind her. But now Cautious Carl has a massive, terrifying responsibility. He has to protect the goldmine of data she just gave him. We have another direct regulatory comparison here. Reg SP versus Reg SID.
The droids.
Yeah, they sound like droids from a sci-fi movie, but they are incredibly potent SEC regulations.
And they govern two completely different directions of threat. Understanding the directional flow of the threat is the key to mastering these two roles.
I use this analogy to keep the directional flow straight. Reg SP is keeping your dog from running out of the house. Reg SID is keeping a burglar from breaking into the house.
That is the perfect mental model. Let's start with the dog running out. Regulation SP, which stems from the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act, is fundamentally about privacy. It protects what the SEC calls non-public personal information, or NPI, from leaking out of the broker-dealer. It governs what Cautious Carl is legally allowed to share with third parties, and it dictates how he physically and technologically safeguards the data inside the firm.
So when you open your mailbox and you get those incredibly dense, tiny font privacy notices from your bank or your credit card company every single year, that's Reg SP in action.
Exactly. The rule dictates that Carl has to give Sally an initial privacy notice the exact moment she opens the account. And then, historically, he has to send her an annual privacy notice every 12 months.
Right.
Now, there's a minor modern exception. If Carl's firm doesn't change its privacy policies at all, and they only share data for standard boring servicing reasons, like, you know, sending data to the company that physically prints the account statements.
Yeah.
They can actually skip the annual notice. But if they're sharing data to market products, you get the notice every year.
And what if Sally reads that notice and decides she doesn't want Carl sharing her data with anyone? She wants total lockdown.
That brings us to the opt-out provision. Carl must give Sally a reasonable opportunity to opt out before he shares her non-public personal information. He has to give her a toll-free number to call, or a simple web form, or a prepaid postcard.
Okay.
He can't make her write a legal letter in blood. But here's the major exam trap, and it trips up seasoned professionals. Customers can opt out of the firm sharing their data with non-affiliated third parties. They generally cannot opt out of the firm sharing data with its own internal affiliates.
Okay, let's unpack that, because that is sneaky. Let's say Cautious Carl's broker-dealer was recently bought out and is now owned by a massive multinational mega bank. Carl wants to share Sally's juicy financial data with the mega bank's mortgage division to try and sell her a house. Because that mortgage division is an affiliate under the same corporate umbrella, Sally usually cannot stop that data sharing under Reg SP.
That is correct.
But if Carl wants to take her data and sell it to some random, completely unaffiliated marketing company in Silicon Valley, she has the absolute right to check the opt-out box and kill that transaction.
Precisely. Affiliates get a free pass. Non-affiliates get blocked by the opt-out. But RegSP isn't just about the legal sharing of data, it's also the safeguards rule. Carl needs to make sure the physical filing cabinets are actually locked. He needs to make sure Departing Dave's laptop is fully encrypted.
Right.
He has to enforce strong passwords. And speaking of safeguards, the SEC just recently passed a massive seismic amendment to this rule that candidates taking the exam right now absolutely need to know.
Yes. The new breach notification rule. Listener, burn this timeline into your brain. Let's play out a scenario. Let's say Departing Dave goes to a local coffee shop to work. He leaves his unencrypted laptop on the table to go to the bathroom and someone steals it. Shady Sally's non-public personal information is on that hard drive. What is the timeline for Carl to react to this disaster?
Under the new RegSP amendments, if sensitive customer information is reasonably likely to be accessed or used without authorization, Cautious Carl firm has exactly 30 days to notify the affected customers.
Not 45 days.
Not 45 days. Not 60 days. They must notify them as soon as practicable, but absolutely no later than 30 days from the moment the firm becomes aware of the breach. This is a massive shift for compliance departments who used to drag their feet for months investigating before telling anyone.
So 30 days for a breach notification. That is Reg SIP. That is keeping the dog from running out. Now let's pivot to the burglar trying to break in, Reg SID, the Identity Theft Red Flags Rule.
Right. Reg SID assumes that the data is already out there in the dark web, and it protects against fraudsters from the outside trying to use that stolen data to impersonate Shady Sally.
Right.
It legally requires the broker-dealer to have a comprehensive, written identity theft prevention program. And for the Series 24 exam, you don't just need to know it exists, you need to memorize the structural math of the program.
Structural math, what do you mean?
Yes. The written program must contain exactly 4 functional elements, and it must address 5 distinct categories of red flags.
Okay, let's hit the 4 functional elements first. How does this program actually work mechanically?
The 4 elements are identify, detect, respond, and update.
Okay.
First, you have to identify what a red flag actually looks like in your specific business model. What does fraud look like here? Second, you build technological and human systems to actually detect those flags when they happen.
Right.
Third, when the system detects one, you must have a procedure to respond appropriately to stop the theft. And fourth, you must periodically update your program because hackers and fraudsters are constantly evolving their tactics.
Identify, detect, respond, update. It's a continuous loop of paranoia. I love it. And what are the 5 categories of red flags that Carl is programming his systems to look for?
So category 1, alerts, notifications, or warnings from consumer reporting agencies. Like if Equifax flags a massive credit freeze on Sally.
Okay.
Category 2, suspicious documents. This is the classic. Someone emails in a copy of a driver's license, but the font is slightly wrong, or the picture clearly isn't Sally. Category 3, suspicious personal identifying information. For example, someone applies for an account using a social security number that the Master Death Index says belongs to someone who died in 1998.
Oh, that's terrifying.
Yeah, it happens more than you think. Category 4, unusual use of or suspicious activity related to the covered account. Imagine an account that hasn't made a single trade in 10 years suddenly liquidating everything and requesting a wire transfer to an offshore crypto exchange.
Huge red flag.
Right. And finally, category 5. Direct notices from customers, victims of identity theft, or law enforcement saying, hey, Carl, this specific account at your firm has been compromised.
Okay, those are the 5 categories. But you just used a very specific phrase in category 4. You said covered account. This is a major exam trap for Reg SID. Does this intense 4-element, 5-category program apply to every single account at the broker dealer?
It does not. It only applies to what the SEC defines as covered accounts. A covered account is generally an account offered or maintained primarily for personal, family, or household purposes that involves or is designed to permit multiple payments or transactions.
Okay, so Shady Sally's standard retail brokerage account where she buys and sells stocks every week.
Absolutely a covered account. The Reg SID program applies in full force.
But what if Carl's firm also has a massive, pure, institutional proprietary trading account for a hedge fund? Or like a corporate account that only does single block trades once a year?
Not a covered account.
Really?
The risk of standard consumer identity theft there is negligible. Criminals aren't usually stealing the identity of a multi-billion dollar hedge fund to open a fake checking account. So there is no Reg SID program required for those specific institutional accounts. The rule targets consumer risk.
That makes perfect sense. Okay, take a deep breath. We are shifting gears entirely. We are moving off the front door and onto the trading floor. The watchful eye, anti-money laundering, CTRs, and SARs. Let's reset the scene. Shady Sally is in the club. She is trading, and she starts moving a lot of cash around. She is truly living up to her name. Cautious Carl is watching the security cameras, and his stress ball is getting a serious workout. He has to rely on his AML compliance program to catch her if she crosses the line.
And that AML program isn't just a suggestion. It is mandated by the Bank Secrecy Act, and it must be built upon the rigid foundation of the five pillars of AML. If a firm is missing even a single one of these pillars, their entire AML program is considered legally deficient in the eyes of FinRA and the SEC. It is an automatic failure.
Let's list these five pillars out and really understand them.
Pillar one, the firm must establish and implement written policies, procedures, and internal controls reasonably designed to achieve compliance. This is the rulebook.
Got it.
Pillar two, the firm must provide for independent testing for compliance to be conducted by member personnel or by a qualified outside party. You have to audit the system. Okay. Pillar three, designation of an individual or individuals responsible for implementing and monitoring the operations and internal controls. This is the AML compliance officer or AMLCO. Pillar four, ongoing training for appropriate personnel. And pillar five, the newest addition, appropriate risk-based procedures for conducting ongoing customer due diligence or CDD.
Okay, I want to drill down on pillar two, independent testing. Let's talk about how often that happens. Does every single broker-dealer in the country have to pay an auditor to test their AML program every single year?
This is like a classic high-frequency exam trap. The answer is no, not every firm. The frequency of the testing depends entirely on the firm's business model.
Okay.
If the firm is a standard customer-facing retail firm, like the one where Carl and Dave work, where they hold funds and execute trades for the public, then yes, they must test their AML program annually based on a calendar year.
But what is the exception?
If a firm is purely proprietary, meaning they have absolutely no retail customer accounts, they don't introduce accounts to a clearing firm, they don't hold public money, they literally just trade their own firm's capital with other broker-dealers, their money laundering risk is significantly lower. Therefore, FinLera allows them to test their program every 2 years.
Okay, so proprietary-only firms test every 2 years. Customer-facing firms test annually. Lock that away in your brain. Now, let's talk about pillar three, the AML compliance officer. Cautious Carl is the AMLCO. Does he have to be a registered principal to hold this title?
Surprisingly, no. The AMLCO does not have to be a registered person. However, they must be a senior member of the firm, and their contact information must be explicitly provided to FinLera. And here is a scary part for Carl. The AMLCO can be held personally, individually liable by the regulators if the AML program is catastrophically deficient. That is why he sweats.
I would sweat too. Now, what about pillar five, the newest one, customer due diligence? What does that actually mean in practice?
Pillar five requires the firm to truly understand the nature and purpose of the customer relationship to develop a customer risk profile.
Yeah.
And the absolute biggest testable point here is the requirement to identify beneficial owners of legal entity customers.
Break that down for me.
Let's say Shady Sally realizes her personal accounts are being watched. So she goes and forms a complex limited liability company, an LLC, and tries to open an account under the LLC's name. Under Pillar 5, Cautious Carl cannot just say, okay, the customer is the LLC.
Right.
He has to look behind the corporate curtain. He must identify any natural human person who owns 25% or more of the equity interests of that legal entity. Plus, regardless of ownership, he must identify at least one control person like a CEO, a chief financial officer, or a managing member.
Okay, let's play with that math because I know the exam well. Let's say Sally sets up an LLC with four of her friends. There are exactly five owners. Each of them owns exactly 20% of the equity. None of them hit that 25% ownership threshold. Does Carl just throw his hands up and say, well, no beneficial owners here. I guess we were done?
Not a chance. Even if no single human being hits the 25% equity threshold, Carl still has to identify and verify the identity of exactly one control person. The government's logic is that a corporation cannot act on its own.
Right.
A human being's finger has to push the button to wire the money. The regulators demand a human throat to choke if the LLC starts laundering cartel money.
A human throat to choke. Vivid, but highly accurate. Okay, this sets up the ultimate Series 24 showdown. We are moving to the reporting mechanisms. The speed bump versus the judgment call, the CTR versus the SAR. These are the two biggest, most important reports. Cautious Carl files with the government under the Bank Secrecy Act. Let's compare them directly.
The CTR is a currency transaction report. It is officially known as a FinCEN Form 112. The rule for the CTR is incredibly rigid and simple. Any transaction or multiple transactions in a single day involving more than $10,000 in physical currency by or on behalf of the same person triggers a CTR.
Okay.
Once triggered, the firm has exactly 15 calendar days to file it with the government. It is entirely objective. It's just pure math. A robot could do it.
Okay, listener, direct question time. Think about this scenario carefully before answering. Shady Sally walks into the branch office. She pulls a stack of physical cash out of her purse and hands it to Cautious Carl. Carl counts it. It is exactly $10,000. Not a single penny more. Does Carl have to file a CTR? Ready. The answer is N-O. The statutory language says it must exceed $10,000. $10,000 and 1 cent triggers the robot. Exactly $10,000 does not. The exam writers will ruthlessly test your reading comprehension on the word exceeds.
That is a classic trick. And there's a second trick embedded in the CTR. It strictly applies to currency, physical cash and coin. The definition matters.
Right. If Sally Wire transfers $50,000 from her bank to her brokerage account, that is a FASF sum, but it is not physical cash. No CTR is filed. If she deposits a $15,000 personal check or a cashier's check, that is not cash. No CTR. It literally has to be physical paper money.
Exactly. The CTR is an artifact of a different era. The $10,000 threshold was set in the 1970s. Adjusted for inflation, that would be nearly $80,000 today, but they never changed the threshold. So today, it acts as a very low speed bump for money launderers.
So that is the CTR, the objective robotic speed bump, 15 days to file, over $10K cash. What about the SAR?
The SAR is the suspicious activity report. If the CTR is the robot, the SAR is the detective. This is entirely a judgment call.
Okay.
A SAR is triggered if a transaction or pattern of transactions involves $5,000 or more in funds or assets. So notice it's not just cash anymore. It could be wires, stocks, journal entries, anything. And the firm knows, suspects, or has reason to suspect that the transaction is tied to illegal activity, is designed to evade the Bank Secrecy Act, or simply has no apparent lawful business purpose.
So the dollar threshold is significantly lower, $5,000 instead of over $10,000. It covers all types of assets, not just cash. But it requires a human being to look at it and say, something feels wrong here. And what is the timeline for Cautious Carl to actually file this report?
The timeline is much longer because it requires investigation. Carl has 30 calendar days to file a SAR from the date he initially detects the suspicious facts. Not the date of the transaction, but the date of detection. Now, if he knows the activity is suspicious, but he hasn't been able to identify a specific suspect yet, the rules allow him a 30-day extension to keep investigating, making it 60 days total. But he can never, under any circumstances, exceed 60 days to file.
Okay, let's put these two reports into the ring together to demonstrate the most famous exam scenario of all time. The structuring trap. I'm going to set the scene. Shady Sally knows the rules. She knows about the $10,000 speed bump. So she walks into the branch on Monday and deposits $9,500 in physical cash. On Tuesday, she comes back, another $9,500 in cash. Wednesday, same exact thing, $9,500 in cash. What does Cautious Carl do?
This is the textbook definition of structuring. Sally is intentionally breaking down a large sum of cash into smaller increments, keeping her daily cash deposits just under the $10,000 threshold to specifically avoid triggering the CTR speed bump. Structuring is, in and of itself, a federal crime.
So the question is, does Carl file a CTR for those days?
No, because on no single calendar day did she actually exceed $10,000. The robot doesn't get triggered. If Carl filed a CTR, it would be rejected because the math doesn't add up. But Carl is not a robot. He is a highly trained compliance principal.
Right.
He sees the pattern across Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. He knows she is structuring. Therefore, Carl must file a SAR. The SAR is the net that catches what the CTR misses.
That is the perfect way to phrase it. The SAR catches what the CTR misses. Okay, let's dial up the drama. It's Thursday. Carl has filed the SAR on Sally for structuring. He sent it to the Treasury Department. Friday morning, Sally logs into her app, sees her account is locked for a compliance review, and storms into the branch office furious. She demands to know what is going on. Can Carl pull her aside and say, listen, Sally, I had to file a suspicious activity report on you. Just lay low for a bit.
If Carl says those words, Carl's going to federal prison. Absolutely. SARs are strictly, unequivocally confidential. The Bank Secrecy Act prohibits any broker-dealer or any employee from disclosing to the customer or any unauthorized third party that a SAR has been filed or is even being considered.
Wow.
It's legally called tipping off. It carries massive criminal penalties because you are effectively warning a potential criminal that federal law enforcement is looking at them.
But wait, let's look at this from the firm's perspective. Sally is furious. Her money is frozen. She hires an aggressive trial lawyer and sues cautious Carl's broker dealer for breach of contract and defamation because they froze her account and secretly reported her to the government. Is the firm about to lose millions in a civil lawsuit?
No, and this is a crucial exam concept. The firm is protected by a statutory safe harbor provision. As long as cautious Carl filed the SAR in good faith, the firm and its employees are completely immune from civil liability to the customer for making the filing or for declining to do business with her.
That is a huge relief for Carl.
Yes, but, and this is the razor's edge, the safe harbor protects the firm for filing the SAR. It does not protect them if they violate the tipping off rule and leak the existence of the SAR to the customer. You cannot tell the customer, ever.
Okay, so picture Carl. He is sitting across the desk from a screaming Shady Sally. He has total civil immunity, but he is completely unable to look her in the eye or defend himself because he cannot legally explain why her account is frozen. He just has to sit there and take it. This is exactly why he has a stress ball.
The psychological pressure on compliance officers in these moments is immense. You are caught between a furious client and the Department of Justice.
Okay, let's escalate this even further. We are moving to the global stage, phase four, the global watchdogs. OFAC versus FinCEN. Let's change the setup. Sally gives up on cash deposits. She logs into her account and attempts to initiate a massive wire transfer to a very obscure, weirdly named corporate entity located overseas. Carl is reviewing the wire transfer, and his screening software flashes bright red. He is suddenly dealing with two massive federal acronyms, OFAC and FinCEN.
These are both powerful bureaus operating within the U.S. Department of the Treasury, but they have completely different mandates, and the exam will relentlessly test your ability to separate their functions and their timelines. Let's start with OFAC. It stands for the Office of Foreign Assets Control. They are the geopolitical sanctions enforcers. They maintain what is known as the SDN list, the sparingly designated nationals list.
What exactly is that list?
It is essentially the United States government's master list of bad guys. It contains the names of known terrorists, international narcotics traffickers, individuals involved in weapons of mass destruction, proliferation, and entities owned or controlled by sanctioned rogue states like North Korea or Iran.
And FinCEN, where do they fit in?
FinCEN is the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network. They aren't dealing with geopolitical sanctions. They are the data nerds of the Treasury. They administer the Bank Secrecy Act. They are the ones who collect, analyze, and disseminate the CTRs and the SARs we just talked about. They look for patterns of domestic and international money laundering.
Here is where the mechanics get incredibly testable. Let's compare their specific timelines and required actions. Let's say Shady Sally's wire transfer recipient actually pops up as a positive match on the OFAC SDN list. Sally is trying to fund a cartel. What is Carl's immediate legal obligation?
If there's a direct match on the SDN list, Carl must instantly block the transaction. Block is the legal term for freeze. He cannot send the money. He cannot return the money to Sally. The funds are frozen in place. Then he must file a blocking report to OFAC within exactly 10 business days.
10 business days to report a frozen asset to OFAC. Does his obligation end there?
No. OFAC requires a comprehensive audit. Carl's firm must file an annual report of all blocked property they are holding, and that report is due every year by September 30th.
Okay, so OFAC is block the money, report in 10 business days, annual report on September 30th. Now, let's run a different scenario. Let's say OFAC isn't involved at all, but FinCEN sends Carl's firm a Section 314A law enforcement information sharing request. FinCEN says, hey, Carl, federal law enforcement is tracking a major domestic money laundering ring. Do you have any accounts matching these five specific names?
Under the Patriot Act information sharing rules, when Carl receives that request from FinCEN, he has exactly 14 calendar days to search his firm's records.
Okay.
He has to scour the account databases, the wire transfer logs, everything. If he finds a positive match, he reports the details back to FinCEN. If he searches and finds absolutely nothing, he is not required to respond at all.
Wait, does he freeze the account if he finds a match for FinCEN?
No. And that is the distinction. With an OFAC match, you block the money immediately. With a FinCEN information request, you do not freeze the account. You do not alert the customer. You simply search the data and report back within 14 calendar days. FinCEN is gathering intelligence. OFAC is enforcing sanctions.
So to summarize for the listener, OFAC equals block the money, report in 10 business days. FinCEN equals search the data, report matches in 14 calendar days. Do not mix those timelines up on test day.
Absolutely. And this brings us to one of the most fascinating regulatory traps in the entire industry, the SEC's sneaky hook.
Oh, I love discussing this.
Yeah.
This is where you see how the regulatory matrix actually operates. Explain how the SEC enforces this stuff using the BSA compliance record keeping rule.
Okay, so let's think about jurisdiction. The SEC is a securities market regulator. Their job is to ensure fair markets and protect investors.
Right.
They do not write federal money laundering laws or international sanctions. The Treasury Department and Congress do that. However, the SEC created a specific rule, Rule 17A8, that essentially says, in order to maintain your registration as a broker-dealer with the SEC, you must strictly comply with all Bank Secrecy Act record-keeping and reporting requirements.
So they took a Treasury law and made it a condition of SEC registration. What does that actually mean for cautious Carl when things go wrong?
It means Carl is facing triple jeopardy. This is a massive conceptual trap for candidates. Let's say Carl gets sloppy and misses the 30-day deadline to file a SAR for Shady Sally. FinCEN is going to investigate and fine him for violating the Bank Secrecy Act. That's one.
Yeah.
FINRA is going to sanction him for failing to follow the firm's written AML program. That's two. And the SEC is going to hit him with a severe books and records violation because he broke their specific BSA compliance rule.
One single missed piece of paper, and you have three separate federal and self-regulatory agencies knocking on your door to issue fines.
Triple jeopardy.
Yeah.
The SEC cleverly used a mundane record-keeping rule to effectively deputize themselves as frontline money laundering enforcers.
And Carl's stress ball finally pops. It all makes sense now.
Yeah.
Okay, we are in the home stretch. The final stage of the customer lifecycle, phase five, the exit. Account statements, transfers, and interference. Let's bring in our third character, departing Dave. Dave is a highly successful registered rep at Carl's firm, but Dave just got a massive signing bonus offer from a rival broker-dealer across the street. He is leaving, and he is trying to take all his clients, including Shady Sally, with him.
A tale as old as Wall Street. The broker transition drama.
Truly. But before they leave, let's talk about a weird quirk in how Sally's account is currently set up. Sally is deeply paranoid about privacy, so she originally asked Carl to make her account a numbered account. She just wants a random symbol or a string of numbers on her monthly statements, no actual name. Can Carl legally do that? It sounds like a Swiss bank movie trope.
It does, but yes, FINRA explicitly allows numbered accounts for customer privacy. Politicians, celebrities, or just highly private people use them. But here's the catch. It is not a truly anonymous account. The firm cannot hide from the government. Carl still knows exactly who she is. He has all her CIP and AML data on file. To legally use a number or symbol on the external statements, Carl just needs to hold a written statement signed by Sally, formally attesting to her ownership of that specific numbered account.
Got it. Written statement on file. Use whatever symbol you want. And how often is Carl legally required to send Sally one of those account statements?
At bare minimum, quarterly. Any account with security position, a money balance, or any account activity must receive a statement at least once every calendar quarter. Now, as a practical matter, most modern firms send them monthly, especially if there is trading activity, but the absolute regulatory floor is quarterly.
Okay, so Dave is packing his desk, and he tells Sally to transfer her numbered account to his new firm. This triggers the ACE system, the Automated Customer Account Transfer Service.
ACEs is the central utility engine that moves assets between broker-dealers. It standardizes the entire transfer process, so firms can't just hoard customer assets indefinitely.
Okay, listener, direct question time again. Think about the logistics. Who initiates the ACEs transfer? Is it cautious Carl at the old firm saying goodbye, take her? Or is it Dave's new firm pulling the assets over? I'll give you a second. The answer is the receiving firm starts the process. Dave has Sally sign the transfer instruction form, known as the TIF, at his brand new firm, and that new firm submits it into ACA's system to pull the assets.
Right. And once cautious Carl receives that electronic TIF through the AC system, the regulatory clock starts ticking lively.
Right.
Carl's firm has exactly one business day to validate the transfer instructions.
Well,
validation simply means Carl checks the system and says, yes, this account number belongs to Sally, her social security number matches, and yes, these are the assets she actually holds here.
And after he validates it on day one.
After validation, Carl's firm has exactly 3 business days to physically deliver the assets over to the new firm. So the total timeline is 1 business day to validate and 3 business days to transfer. 1 and 3.
But let's look at the human element. Cautious Carl is furious. Departing Dave was his best producing rep, and he is taking millions of dollars in assets out the door. Can Cautious Carl just drag his feet? Can he delay the validation or slow walk the transfer just because he's mad Dave is leaving and hurting the firm's revenue?
Absolutely not. This brings us to a very strictly enforced FINRA rule, the prohibition against transfer interference. A firm cannot interfere with, delay, or block a customer's request to transfer their account simply because their representative is changing jobs. Doing so violates the core mandate of observing just and equitable principles of trade. The customer's money and the customer's money.
But are there any valid legal reasons for Carl to tap the brakes on an AKS transfer?
Yes. The only major, widely tested exception that allows a firm to delay a transfer is if there's a bona fide lien against the account. For example, if Sally was trading heavily on margin and owes Carl's firm a massive margin debit balance, or if she has unpaid maintenance fees, Carl's firm essentially has a lien on her assets. Carl can absolutely delay the transfer until Sally liquidates enough stock to pay off her debt to the old firm.
Okay, here is the devious exam trap related to that. What if the situation is reversed? What if Carl's firm actually owes Sally money? Let's say she just sold a bunch of stock and has a massive credit balance in cash sitting in her account. Can Carl use that credit balance as an excuse to delay the transfer, claiming it complicates the math?
No. And the exam will try to trick you with this. A credit balance is not a lien. The lien exception only applies when the customer owes the firm money. If the firm owes the customer money, a credit balance, they have zero right to delay. They have to pack up that cash and send it across the street with the rest of the transfer.
Okay, one more scenario. What if Carl is just being incredibly petty? What if he follows the timeline perfectly, he validates in one day, he delivers in 3 days, but during the process, he invents a fake reason to force Dave's new firm to resubmit the paperwork? He demands a secondary signature from Sally that isn't actually required by FINRA rules, just to be annoying and make Dave look bad to his client.
That is called taking a pretextual exception, and it is a massive rule violation. Even if the final transfer happens within the standard 1 and 3 day windows, inventing a fake hurdle or requiring unnecessary documentation violates the transfer interference prohibition. The rule aggressively protects the customer's right to move their money freely and without friction. Carl cannot play games.
So ultimately, Carl has to let Dave and Shady Sally walk out the door. The nightclub is officially closed for them, and they are off to a new venue.
That is the nature of the brokerage business. Clients come, clients go, but the regulatory obligations remain forever.
Okay, my brain is officially full, but we have to lock this in for the listener. Time for the rapid fire recap. Listener, I want you answering these out loud or in your head before we give the answer. I'll tee them up, you knock them down. Let's go.
I'm ready.
What is the record retention requirement for CIP identity verification data?
5 years post-closure.
What is the record retention requirement for the FANRA customer account profile information?
6 years post-closure.
What is the minimum required age for someone to be named a trusted contact person?
18 years old.
What is the exact threshold and timeline to file a currency transaction report, a CTR?
Over $10,000 in physical cash filed within 15 calendar days.
What is the dollar threshold and standard timeline to file a suspicious activity report, a SAR?
$5,000 or more, filed within 30 calendar days of initial detection.
What is the standard ACCAS transfer timeline?
1 business day to validate, 3 business days to transfer.
Under the new Reg SP amendments, what is the deadline for customer breach notification?
As soon as practicable, but no later than 30 days.
Absolutely nailed it. Okay, before we sign off, I want to leave the listener with a final provocative thought to chew on. When you look at all this source material, what is the biggest conceptual takeaway for a candidate preparing to sit for this exam?
I want the listener to deeply consider the philosophical shift embedded in that SEC-BSA record-keeping rule we discussed. Society generally treats money laundering as a violent, kinetic, criminal issue. It's cartels, it's terrorist financing, it's bad actors doing terrible things.
Right.
But the SEC isn't a criminal prosecutor, they are an administrative market regulator. By making money laundering compliance a strict record-keeping condition of registration, the SEC fundamentally changed the very nature of paperwork.
Oh, wow.
A single missed suspicious activity report isn't just a minor administrative slip-up or a typo. It transforms instantly into a multi-agency federal case that threatens the broker-dealer's very right to exist.
That's intense.
When you sit down in that testing center for the Series 24, remember that you aren't just memorizing dry filing deadlines and retention schedules. You are learning how to defuse ticking time bombs. Every unfiled form, every missed 30-day window is a direct threat to the firm's survival.
Wow. That puts it into perspective. That is exactly why they test this Function 3 material so ruthlessly. The stakes could not possibly be higher. Listener, if you can master the bouncer at the front door, checking IDs, the algorithms watching the floor, and the strict rules for the exit, you are going to absolutely crush this section of the exam. Keep studying, keep grinding, remember cautious, Carl, and we will catch you on the next deep dive.